Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Podcast. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host. The segment you're about to hear originally ran as episode number 24 of the Cryptographic Podcast. In it, Damian and Brian continue their discussion with Bob Retail about horror comics. This episode was originally released on the Cryptographic Podcast feed on June 5th, 2008.
Greetings, cryptographers, and welcome to Cryptographic, a transcontinental podcast featuring news, reviews, interviews, and commentary covering horror, dark fantasy, and science fiction. I'm Damian, reporting from Australia.
And I'm Brian, coming to you from the United States. Visit our portal with streaming audio and video at cryptographic.ning.com.
Visit our website at lordshaper.com/cryptographic for show notes and links related to each episode, along with a link to the Furnace forums, which can be found at lordshaper.com/forum.
You can email comments to cryptographic@lordshaper.com or leave us a voicemail at 206-279-9143. And this episode, we have the second half of our two-part Comics with Bob segment. Last episode, we discussed Swamp Thing and Hellblazer and just a number of horror comics. This episode, we speak mostly about Lock and Key from IDW, written by Joe Hill. And I think we talk about some other horror comics, too. And
as per usual, we go off on our general tangents there as well. So hope you enjoy it. And here goes with part two.
Next up, we have Joe Hill's Lock and Key, published by IDW. A number of people didn't realize that Joe Hill's father is Stephen King, and fewer people realize that his mother is novelist Tabitha King, and she has, I don't know, half a dozen or a dozen novels out herself. So he's kind of a pedigreed author, and
so where does the Hill come from? Do you know at all?
I've no idea. I'm still working on that one. I've actually talked to a couple of people who've asked me that question, and I haven't come up with a good answer for that.
It might have been his mother's maiden name or something like that, and he's just taken it so he's not running off the Stephen King name. That's what I would assume.
Like Nicholas Coppola did when he became Nick Cage.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and I respect that. Same thing with Emilio Estevez and Martin Sheen.
Yeah, even when also, Stephen King actually put out his books as Richard Bachman just to see if they would actually sell, if they weren't just buying them for the name.
There were actually a couple of reasons behind that. That's part of it. That's undeniably part of it. But also part of it is because the Bachman books were books that didn't really fit in the Stephen King brand. And he was actually limited to putting out no more than two books a year. Like most, you know, from when I worked in bookstores, most novelists only put out one book a year. They'll put out a hardcover. Roughly 9 months later, it'll come out in trade, and usually no sooner than a year after the first hardcover comes out, they'll come out with another hardcover. When I worked in bookstores in the early 90s, it was only Stephen King, Danielle Steele, and I don't know, maybe Dean Koontz that were putting out hardcovers and trade paperbacks every 6 months. Pretty much every 6 months you'd have a new Stephen King hardcover, and the last one would come out as a mass market, really, not a trade paperback. So that was another way to kind of get around that, only being allowed to put out two novels a year by his publisher. He could put out more novels if he released them as Richard Bachman, because, you know, people write so many novels in a goddamn year. Jesus Christ. But
yeah, especially when they're really short ones like Stephen King, huh?
Yeah, you know.
I just type pretty freaking fast.
He must be working on about five things at once, and he's just pulling out what he's in the mood for.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's not to say that he doesn't print a couple, you know, six or eight short stories in various magazines over the course of a year, too. It must be nice. You know, and Tabitha King is definitely no slouch as far as novelist. She obviously doesn't have, you know, Stephen King's reputation, but, you know, there's not a lot of people who do. But Joe Hill, you know, you got to say he's definitely trying to make his own name. He's not trying to trade on his father's name. You know, it definitely would have been easy to come out as Joe King or Joseph King. But, and, you know, and Hill might have nothing to do with anything except it might actually be a joke on King, you know, the King of the Hill.
Yeah, could be the hill he's got to climb to beat the King.
Yeah, you know, he's got a long hill to climb to top his father. But with that, he has a short story collection and a novel out. The novel won the Bram Stoker Award. I think it's called Heart-Shaped Box. And he has, I forget the short story collection's name, but if it didn't win the Bram Stoker Award, it was nominated, I think.
His middle name is Hillstrom.
Okay.
Joseph Hillstrom King.
There you go.
Second child of Stephen and Tabitha King. Used an abbreviated form of his middle name.
There you go. Another mystery solved.
A reference to executed labor leader Joe Hill, for whom he was named.
Huh.
Anyway, I digress. Sorry.
We always digress. Don't worry about it.
That's pretty well expected on this show. You know, there's no apologies necessary. At any rate, back to the actual book, Lock and Key. You know, I gotta say, I've seen it praised pretty much universally as much as I've seen reviews online for it. I've seen people say that they don't even read comics, but they like Joe Hill's prose, and so they picked it up and they liked it, you know, just based on the first issue. And I gotta say, I was really underwhelmed coming off the first issue. And I'm entirely in the minority opinion, but I can't explain. Besides the fact that I went into it pretty much feeling like, you know, this is practically the Watchmen of horror comics, the way people have been carrying on about it, I really felt like it started with kind of a random murder of a character that we really didn't know. You had a couple of kids, but you really only got to know one of them. You didn't really get to know his brother and sister's character. And then, you know, they go off to this house, and, you know, there's lots of flashbacks back and forth filling in some of the backstory and stuff. And at the house, you see this kind of weird ending at the end of the first issue with the ghost, and it just kind of cuts off. And so I really came away from it feeling like I only kind of knew one character. I wasn't real attached to any of the other characters, including the one who had the ghost experience at the end, not to spoil it too much. And you just kind of had a random murder of a character you didn't really know. And I really didn't get why everyone was so excited about the first issue. I spoke to someone else about it, and they said that if I wasn't real enthusiastic about the first issue, I'll probably really like it after the second issue. So I'm waiting to get into that. But
I read the second issue. Kind of tying back to the beginning of the episode, the first issue should have been a zero issue, because it was pretty much set up for getting them to this house. And the door that the little boy goes through, and, you know, what happens to him there at the end of the first issue, this is, I think, going to be the basic point of this whole series. It's the fact that they're in this weird old house that the father who got murdered, you know, it's his, you know, where he grew up, and there's just all kinds of weird stuff going on in this house and with these characters and stuff. And this is the actual point of the series, I think, is this house and, you know, what goes on there. So the first issue, kind of like the background, what happens and what gets them to the house.
Right. And I definitely see what you're saying. That it definitely would make more sense as a zero issue, I think, because it definitely speaks to what we were talking about earlier regarding a zero issue filling in, you know, some of the back history that's not necessarily the first chapter, but kind of, you know, fills in some of the backstory and some of the motivation for the characters. I know a little bit about the gist of the story as far as the house and everything from interviews and from things I've read online and stuff. But the house is the whole story from what I've gathered online, and I really felt like that wasn't set up at all in the first issue.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they just got there in the last couple of pages. So, again, when you read the second issue, I think, you know, that'll be – if you don't like the second issue, you should probably drop the series. But it kind of kicks up a notch, in my opinion, in the second issue. I mean, I liked the first issue, but I kind of saw – I kind of looked at the first issue, and I wasn't bowled over by it, but I was interested enough, especially – with the hook that they gave me at the end with the little boy, you know, getting to the house, you know, that was what kind of hooked me. And it's like, okay, that's interesting. I want to check out the second issue and see what happens. And then the second issue, it just, you know, it really takes off from there.
Right. And I'm kind of wondering if he's kind of writing at a novelist pace with this book, if you get my meaning. You know, in a novel, I mean, you buy the novel, you don't necessarily turn it down or, you know, or stop reading the novel if it starts out a little slow. If you're interested in the characters, you'll get through the novel. And I'm kind of getting the same kind of feel that, you know, the first issue, he was really trying to establish the characters, and like I said, to what extent, you know, he was successful, and I'm not 100% with, but I think that he was trying to set up a lot of things in the first issue, and I don't know, I'm almost feeling like, not that he was specifically writing for the trade, but that this might actually read better as a trade than as single issues.
Maybe. I think that once you get through the first issue, and since the first issue's out now, you can pretty much buy issue one and two. I'm suspecting that that's not the case. Like, for instance, I go back to the Moon Knight relaunch, and that one, it seemed to me like nothing happened for the first three issues of it. You know, it's just, you know, that's kind of like writing for the trade to me, where the first issue of Lock and Key, it didn't exhibit that to the extent, because there was some background and stuff, but things happened. I mean, you had, you know, when I think of writing for the trade, I mean, it didn't get into the full-on, you know, aspects of what's going to make this series really interesting, but there was quite a lot of stuff that happened in the first issue. And sure, it was background and everything, but there was establishing the characters. There was, you know, some action in there. There was, you know, coming to the new house. There was just lots of different things that went on. And then again, to me, the hook at the end with the little boy going through the door, you know, that was enough to, I thought it was done well in the context of a monthly comic book, because they ended the issue with a couple of pages with what I like to call a hook that's going to make me want to come back for the next issue. You know, so I thought it was successful in that. I mean, was it the greatest issue of anything I'd ever read? No, but it was good enough to make me want to come back for the next month. So.
Right. And like I said, my impression is probably colored by the rave reviews that it was getting online. I'm definitely not doubting that. And I may be coming down on it a little harder than I would have if it wasn't getting so much praise online. So, you know, I would definitely allow for that, no doubt.
I had a very different point going into it, because I had not seen all of the hype about the book. Really, I saw a couple of people who have recommended things to me before that I have similar tastes to, said, wow, this is a great series, you should check it out. So that was pretty much all I went on. I didn't have – it wasn't built up to be, you know, just the greatest thing since sliced bread or anything. So I can understand feeling differently if you had been led to believe, you know, something along those lines.
You know, another thing that kind of threw me off is the uncle and the mother. Like, I didn't really – the uncle almost looks kind of like his cousin. It doesn't really look like his uncle is old enough to be his uncle. And, you know, I it was really weird for me. You know, like I said, you know, he's sitting there in the funeral home with this guy who's supposed to be his uncle, who doesn't really look any older than he is, and then they're driving in the car, and then when they get out of the car, you see this woman talking, and like, I didn't even realize that was their mother. You know, I didn't know if that was their mother or their aunt or like who that was even. You know, like no one even said, you know, Ma or anything. Like, you know, there was no real obvious indication that that was their mother. You know, like all that stuff kind of comes together because I started reading the second issue. I didn't get all the way through it before we started recording, and they kind of clear up some of that stuff in the beginning of the second issue, but.
Well, you kind of got it in the first issue, but they're doing some nonlinear storytelling here where you kind of flash back after they arrive at the house to, you know, what the mother does, you know, with the guys who broke into the house, and they call her mom at that point. So you kind of catch into it, but it is kind of jumping back and forth a little bit.
Right, and I didn't even know if she went to jail or not after that because – you know, it's not, like I said, real obvious. Like, when they're for example, when he's sitting there with his uncle at the funeral, where is his mother?
Well, one would imagine that she's, like, in the actual, you know, because he's sitting out in the vestibule. I would imagine she's in the other room with all the people.
Oh, well, I know, but it would have been nice if she came out and saw how he was doing or something. you know, and obviously, this isn't, you know, page by page. It's not covering every minute of what happened. And, you know, I mean, you don't know what happened between the panels or whatever. I'm just saying on panel, just to kind of, you know, and again, this is what I was getting at when I was speaking with somebody else about this. You didn't really feel like any of the relationships were really established. You know, you don't really feel any relationship between the brothers and sisters. You don't really feel any relationship between the kids and the parents. You know, I was really it seemed kind of like there were these characters all kind of floating around in the story, bumping into each other. But, you know, I didn't get, like, a strong feeling that there were connections between the characters.
Well, since I haven't actually read it myself, I can't really contribute much to it.
I kind of got more out of the first issue than you did, I think, because, I mean, to me, again, it wasn't so, I didn't know what to expect, but I thought there was, like, the scene at the beginning of the first issue where you got the siblings down at the pond and the little kids in the water and, you know, I thought that there was characterization there, the sibling characterization. I mean, the little kid's much younger than the brother. The daughter is very aloof. You can tell she's got all the piercing. She's got the, you know, the braided hair and everything. She's not on the same wavelength as, you know, this little kid. And then they have this horrific thing happen. So, you know, that's going to mess up relationships in and of itself. You know, you have sister saving the little brother, and, you know, while the guys come in, and, you know, that showed some characterization to me anyway.
I mean, but I almost want to say you're mixing the characters, because he's the angsty, aloof one. She's the one saying, why don't you lighten up and enjoy yourself, and he's the one saying that he's experiencing boredom and existential angst. So it was actually that even though she's got the piercings and, I don't know, she's got dreadlocks or what.
I was talking more about her relationship to the little boy, not the older brother.
But again, like, I don't know. I didn't really get that. I mean, you see her, again, just flipping through the pages, see her telling the older brother to, you know, lighten up and stop being so aloof. And then you see her hiding and protecting the younger brother.
That's so terrible. There's some relationship. You just said there was none.
Well, I didn't say there was absolutely none. I just said I didn't feel like it was really strongly fleshed out. But to your point, I think part of it is because he was trying to put a lot in the first issue. Like you said, I mean, there was a lot of jumping back and forth, and there was a lot of movement. There were a lot of scenes. There are undeniably a lot of scenes in the book. And some of the transitions were pretty clever, like the scene when he's sitting in the vestibule with his uncle, and then you see from one panel to the next, you see his uncle kind of drops out of the panel, and you see him as a little boy walking towards the room where his parents are talking. Like, that's a very, very subtle way of doing a flashback, and you only really even get what's going on if you catch it because the kid's wearing the same hat, you know, like 10 years later or whatever. You know, he's a little boy in this scene, but he's wearing the same hat in the beginning of the story where he's like a teenager. So, the flashback transitions were pretty subtle, I think, some of the time. At least that one. I'm trying to find another one here because I know there had to be another one. The second one, I'm sorry, wasn't subtle at all. He's basically walking off into the woods, and then on the next panel, it's a flashback to the end of the scene where the guys broke in. And then, actually, the transition from the flashback back to the present is a little more, I don't know if it's necessarily subtle, but it's a little smoother. It's not a jump cut transition like the other one.
It goes through a couple of, I mean, there he is at the funeral, and then all of a sudden he's at the house.
Right. So, I like definitely what the artist was trying to do with some of the transitions. You know, and one thing I kind of blanked on, but one of the guys who broke in, do you see where he's kind of talking to himself or someone's talking to him in his cell?
Yep.
I wonder where that's going. Do they
That develops in issue two.
Okay. All right. So that's
a very interesting way.
See, that's cool. So I'm curious to see that. Like I said, I got a little bit of an idea of the ghosty thing with the kid towards the end of the book because, like I said, I did read the beginning of the second issue. I know that people are really, really praising his prose, and you're at least the second person to tell me that even if I was a little mixed on the first issue, because regardless of how I came across, I really didn't hate the first issue. I just didn't think it was as strong as I was led to believe. But you're the second person to tell me that I'll probably like the second issue a lot more than the first.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I wasn't jumping up and down thinking the first issue was the greatest comic I had ever read. It was kind of like, you know, it was a good comic. It wasn't a great comic. Number two was definitely a notch up, though.
Yeah, and also you got to remember, I'm coming off reading Hellblazer Joyride, and Andy Diggle's first issue knocked it out of the park. You know, Andy Diggle definitely wasn't warming up, but Andy Diggle also, you know, this wasn't Andy Diggle's first comic he's writing either. To my knowledge, Joe Hill has written prose, but this is his first comic. So, you know, like I said, I mean, I'm in for the long haul. I'm interested enough to keep going with it. So, I'll give it a qualified recommendation. I recommend people not be discouraged if you're not blown away by the first issue. How about that?
Yeah, you should give the second issue a shot. You know, I would almost go so far as to say you could probably start reading it at issue two and not lose that much. In fact, you could start reading it at issue two, and if you really like issue two, then you can go back and buy issue number one, and it'll fill in some backstory for you.
Yeah, see, that's funny, too, because like I said, I only read the first couple of pages in the second issue, and I think I got more from the first couple of pages of the second issue than I got from the first issue, because it talked about the kid in school and just the interaction between the mother and the uncle talking about the kid. I felt like I got to know those three characters better in the first couple of pages than I did in the first book.
Yeah, I agree with you. And again, that's why I thought that the first issue should kind of been a zero issue.
Right.
You know, I think that, you know, that's if someone hasn't read it, starting at issue two is not necessarily a bad thing.
Sure.
You know, because issue number two, if you're not going to like issue number two, in my opinion, you're not going to like the series. On the other hand, you could be lukewarm about issue one and then subsequently like the series. I think it's similar in that respect to my reaction to Dr. Sleepless.
Okay, so here's where we'll diverge, because we pretty much like Dr. Sleepless from page one, so. But, you know, being, you know, one step away from being the Ellis cast at this point, you know, we haven't not talked about Warren Ellis in a couple of episodes, so we're probably not the best judges on that one, or at least the most objective. But, yeah, we'll have to do a Transmetropolitan retrospective soon.
I like Transmet a lot. I read it all in trade, though.
Yeah. Yeah, see, I was getting that.
It was Helix.
Right.
That's been a Helix.
Yeah, well, yeah, the first 10 or 12 issues, I think, were Helix, and then it switched over because I was getting it in single issues from the first issue. Transmet was just so much fun. It was just so off the rails. It, you know, that's when Warren Ellis was really, I want to say his writing was fearless. When he was writing Hellstorm and Druid and Ruins at Marvel, I don't know if you've read any of that stuff. Forget it. He had more ideas on a page than people put in a book. I mean, the Hellstorm, I mean, you know, on some forums online, I'm known as Hellstorm. It's because of Warren Ellis' run. I mean, that book, he took Damon Hellstrom from being some fruity character running around in booties and a cape to really being the son of Satan. I mean, he, like, one of the first things he did is take over the Satanic Church. And, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of crazy stuff. There's, like, there's a storyline with this priest who gets possessed and deconsecrates a church. And, you know, there's like this slaughter of all these priests, and there's a magician who's slaughtering other magicians and using their organs to make magical armor, and it's just...
This is where we'll have to diverge, because I actually like the fruity son of Satan and the booties and a cape. I loved that when I read it in the 70s. I mean, I read that off the rack when I was a kid, and I loved that series. And in my opinion of the Hellstorm is similar to my opinion of Morrison's Doom Patrol. It's like it's a completely different character.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Ellis's run on Hellstorm is probably about as close as Marvel has ever gotten to putting out a Vertigo book. It was really, you know, if we were at DC, it would have been a Vertigo book. And same thing with what he did with Druid for four issues before that got canned. Ruins was pretty much the anti-Marvels by Busiek and Ross. It was two issues where it was basically everything goes wrong. Like, the Hulk, instead of, you know, gamma rays making him a superhero, he like gets horrible cancer and dies, and it's just like, oh, it's just ruins it. You know, I get what he was saying when he said that most people didn't get the joke, because if you have a sense of humor like Warren Ellis, or I suppose like me, it's savagely darkly comedic. But if you have any kind of reverence for those characters, it's probably borderline traumatic to read Warren Ellis' Ruins. But I still love those books. Those books are crazy. And then, like I said, then coming off of that, he was supposed to do a mature reader Satana book. and he put the first page of the script online. And I don't know how far he got beyond that, because that was, I want to say, right around the time they did those Heroes Reborn books. And they just canned anything that was too mature or too far from being like really superheroic. Like at one point, what's his name from Faust? David Quinn was writing Doctor Strange, and even Warren Ellis wrote a couple of issues of Doctor Strange. And again, it was, I guess, too weird or too far from what they wanted to do with Doctor Strange, and they booted him and they went back to, superhero Doctor Strange. But, there was a real short period of time where, I don't know, somebody slipped at Marvel and let a bunch of horror guys in to write some really borderline Vertigo-esque books, and then the captain resumed control of the wheel and steered it back into superhero land, and that was pretty much the end of it. And then you saw, Warren Ellis split off for DC, and he did, Garth Ennis and Warren Ellis both did Legends of the Dark Knight runs that were, again, borderline horror stories. And then Warren Ellis did Transmet, which was science fiction, but even some of the science in there was almost horrific. But that's what I mean when I say Warren Ellis was fearless, because Warren Ellis would just do any damn thing, and you had no idea, and you had to buy the next issue because the last issue was bananas. And you're seeing that a little bit with the stuff he's doing at Avatar, but even still, I don't think it's as crazy as it was back then.
I think he was spending a lot of time with Grant Morrison, to be honest. And because he had The Invisibles coming out then as well, and it was the same sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't think they're part of the same circles at all, to be fair. I'm going to go out on a limb and make that assumption. All right, so anyway, in conclusion, we really liked Andy Diggle's Hellblazer and recommend everybody pick that up. And we feel that even if you think Joe Hill's Lock and Key starts out a little slow, it picks up by the second issue, and you should probably give that a shot too. As for the rest of the stuff, well, hey, I mean, we pretty much hit the gamut of horror comics the last 20 years, I think, at some point. At least the most well-known ones. I mean, obviously, there were tons of horror comics that we didn't get close to, from Caliber and from Caliber to Chaos.
Which, actually, I was just going through. I'm putting in, where is it? The Cryptic Writings of Megadeth from Chaos Comics.
Wow, you bought those, huh? Okay.
Well, someone.
Hey, a lot of people did. Chaos was around for a while. I didn't get them, though. I like the Caliber books. Kind of passed on the Chaos books. But that's for another episode.
Yeah.
Well, we want to thank you, Bob, for joining us for probably much longer than you expected. And definitely want to recommend people check out the Comic Book Page podcast at comicbookpage.com. Like I said, it's one of the comic podcasts that I always make sure I get back to every week. And
all variations of it.
Yeah.
Keep up with what's going on in the comics without actually having to buy all those comics.
I know. It's great. I know. I don't have to read any superhero comics, and I have the gist of what's going on in both universes. It's awesome.
We cover indie books, too.
True, true. Every episode, one DC, one Marvel, one indie. So I'm definitely not trying to slight you in any way.
And a lot of times we'll double up on the indies, because when we do extra ones, they're usually an extra book, because there's just too many good books that come out from non-Marvel and DC to kind of fit them all in.
And if you're at all interested in the business of comics, you need to check out the Mayo Report episodes, because you're not going to get information anything like that anywhere else. No one else is doing the kind of analysis of what's shipping and the trends over time of what's shipped like John Mayo does. And definitely you got to respect him. No one can get close to that guy. I mean, there's a couple of people that do stuff like that, like the guy that does, the Comic Chronicles page? That and John's affiliated with that page, too.
Yeah, the John Jackson Miller does that for Comic Buyer's Guide, I think.
Right. And so, I mean, there, not to say that there aren't other people, you know, looking at the trends and reporting on them and stuff, but they're definitely few and far between, and nobody else is doing it in a podcast. So if you're at all interested in what's currently going on in the market and what's gone on historically in the market, you got to check out the Mayo Report.
Yeah, and you can see, John has a section on the website with the charts and everything where you can actually get access to the numbers up there on the website, too. And Damien, and hopefully you'll start doing it too, Brian, but, you know, on the previews episode, I always look forward to what Damien's going to be talking about each previews episode, because he'll usually shine a light on some different comics. And I usually get most of them, but John doesn't, so it's very interesting.
Well, I was in on the first previews podcast, but then it always winds up conflicting with me editing Cryptographics. So
you could just record some short MP3s anytime, you know, for weeks, because
we were talking about this.
They're up on the web for the last 2 weeks, you know.
But we were talking about this at one point when I said I'm just recording mine now or something. I said we were talking via email, me and Brian, and. You went through and you wrote out points that you wanted to talk about and everything with it, didn't you, with the first one you did? Well,
right.
I literally just plugged the microphone in and hit record and just let it all spew out of my mouth, which is a totally different thing.
Right, because I'll go through and I'll pick out a bunch of books, and then I'll say, well, I don't want to just read the solicitation. I want to kind of get a little background. So then I'll go and I'll research the books, and then I'll come up with what I want to talk about with the different books and stuff. And, you know, it would be easier if I just read the solicitations, but, you know, I'm just not happy with that.
Well, you don't have to read the solicitations. You can, you know, if there's something that you read monthly and a trade collection's coming out on it, you know, you can talk about that, why somebody should get the trade. Or you don't have to talk about that particular issue, but, you know, you've been enjoying, I don't know, Hellblazer, for instance, when you're getting the trades on that. But when the next trade comes out, without reading the solicitation, similar to what we're doing here, is like, hey, you know, Andy Diggle's been doing a fabulous run, and I'm really looking forward to reading the Laughing Magician volume because Joyride just hit it out of the park, you know, that kind of thing. It doesn't have to be reading the solicitation, because it's more interesting to hear what's the thought process that went into you deciding to put your money down to buy that issue or that trade that you're going to be putting on your previews order.
Like, to be honest, I'm not buying everything that I'm putting on there, otherwise my wife would be divorcing me. But there's things that stick out to me as something that, you know, this would be something that I'll be interested in.
Well, you would buy it if you could.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, you see, well, to be fair, I don't remember which books I plugged in the first previews podcast, but I'm nearly positive that I bought all of them. But, like, I bought that Succulenta Vampire Temp. No, it wasn't a Vampire Temp. Maybe it was.
That
Succulenta book was hysterical. The Moonstone book by the guys from Bongo, that book is funny as hell. That was excellent. I think I probably bought everything that I recommended that first episode. One thing I probably would have liked to have plugged in the last one that was in the last previews was the Johnny Dynamite trade paperback. I don't know. Did anyone mention that?
No.
Oh. Are you guys at all familiar with it?
Isn't it like a reprint of something like European?
No, it was actually, it's Max Allen Collins, who...
Oh.
Right, yeah. Ms. Tree, and he's got, is it the Nate Heller mystery novels?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And he wrote Mickey Spillane's Mike Danger for Techno Comics, and he did a 4-issue miniseries for Dark Horse called Johnny Dynamite. And it's basically like a noirish detective type of story, but with demons. Almost, it's not like The Damned, but it's kind of that era, and it's kind of that kind of detective with demons type of thing, but it's a very different take on it because they're just very different writers. But, oh, wow, what a great book. That was such a fun book. You know, while the Damned is maybe like gangsters and demons in, you know, Prohibition era Chicago or something, Johnny Dynamite is more like, I don't know, Cal McDonald in the early days of Las Vegas or something. It's a really crazy book, really fun book. And I think it's been out of print since those first 4 issues came out through Dark Horse. And I don't think they're doing the trade either. I think it's coming out from another publisher. So if I were to have plugged anything, it probably would have been Johnny Dynamite, because that was such a cool miniseries back then that a lot of people missed and just hasn't been in print since.
That sounds cool. I wish you would have done that. Yeah, because that's the thing. It's like there's so many books, and right, I read previews cover to cover. And every time we do the preview Skype call, which is happening on Friday, and whenever we pull together the previews episode, there's always stuff on there that people will talk about that just totally escape my notice, but after hearing somebody talk about, you know, why they're excited about it, a lot of times I'll pick these books up, and I like a lot of them. So,
yeah, there was another one too. I think it's called The Silent Game. It's a graphic novel written by Stephen Grant and with art by Tom Mandrick, and that one looks really cool too. There are a couple of books. Steve Niles and Bernie Wrightson are doing Dead She Said, which I think was a little bit to Murder, She Wrote, but it's, you know, Steve Niles and Bernie Wrightson, and I don't think it's going to be like an English cozy mystery, but I think that's kind of, you know.
Yeah, I'm getting that.
They're having a little bit of fun with the title. Yeah, I mean, there were definitely a couple of interesting new titles in the last issue of previews, but
yeah,
you know,
I'm getting that Dead She Said one, but I don't think we talked about it on the episode.
Yeah, and that Silent Game one looks pretty good too. It's another crime gangster thing, but you kind of expect that from Stephen Grant. I mean a lot of people know him from the infamous Stephen Grant Mike Zeck Punisher miniseries, but
he did Whisper too.
Yeah, I mean he's done a ton of crime comics and stuff, and he's a really good writer. And so, I mean, pretty much when I saw Stephen Grant and Tom Mandrake on the book, I mean, I almost didn't care what it was about. but anyway, we will let you go, and we will welcome you back maybe when I get that next Hellblazer trade. And say hi to John for us.
Okay.
Is he still overseas at the moment?
No, actually, he just stopped back yesterday. He took today off to try to get himself back into this time zone, and we recorded the latest episode this afternoon right before I came on with you guys, and he just put it up. We tried to get it done really quick so that we wouldn't be that late, because normally our episodes go up on Monday. We got this one up on Tuesday, which isn't too bad since he was out of the country for a little over a week. We pretty much stayed on the schedule pretty good.
That's awesome. You guys are more ambitious than we are.
Our schedule is we'll get episodes out.
Well, you got weekly, and the name of that show is Weekly Comic Spotlight, so we kind of you know, painted ourselves into a putting it out weekly kind of corner. We haven't missed a week yet. We're on this episode 32, so we've been.
I think we started off trying to be weekly, and I think, you had problems at home with that. You spend too much time in front of the computer because
We've descended to monthly, but
there are other things in the pipeline to help people with that.
Yes, we may be padding the feed shortly with things to keep people interested in between episodes. So we'll let you guys know how that works out, because we have to leave on a cryptic note. It's cryptographic. And I'd like to thank Bob for joining us and taking some time from the Comic Book Page podcast to discuss horror comics with us, which, like he said, he doesn't get a chance to do too often on the Comic Book Page podcast, because that's not a genre that his co-host follows. But there is plenty of good stuff on the Comic Book Page podcast, and you should definitely check that out. You should also check out the most recent Comic Timing podcast, where I, along with a couple of other comics podcasters, including Ian Levenstein, the host of Comic Timing, discuss purchasing comics online with the guys from Heroes Corner. Heroes Corner is a way to order new comics online where you pay in advance, but you get a much better discount than I've seen available in any brick-and-mortar comic shop. You know, I average probably around 37 to 38% off of retail ordering through Heroes Corner, and I've been very happy with their service as far as response time, shipping time, everything. It's been really great. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, check them out at heroescorner.com.
Yeah, maybe we can talk them into getting some branches over here on this side of the world so I can actually get some decent discounts for once. And also, you very soon, if not already by the time this is actually out, episode 4 of Welcome to Heavenside will be out. And I just have to give a bit of a shout out to Kat and Josh, who actually did the new banner for that. So if you check it out at heavenside.lordshaper.com. And Comic Timing, you can actually go to speakgeekspeak.com/comic timing to actually view all the episodes there. I think it was 64 was the last one with you on there, Brian. And yeah, that's all for us today. So remember, you can visit us at lordshaper.com/cryptographic and email us at cryptographic@lordshaper.com. Also, you can go to myspace.com/cryptographic or find Brian and myself on MySpace at myspace.com/radiofurnace for myself, and myspace.com/hellstorm_KGK for Brian. We're also members of Facebooks, where you can search for me as Damian Smith and Brian as Brian Matus, and there's also a Fans of Cryptographic group there, so join up and, you know, get in on all the fun there as well. And lastly, you can actually call us on the new voice line, which is 206-279-9143, and leave us a message.
Also, join us at the forums at lordshaper.com/forum, where you can discuss the podcast and any other related stories, movies, music, books, whatever. You know, there's conversations going on there actually for a while. We haven't promoted it too much before, but we're kind of going in a different direction, and we definitely want to promote the lordshaper.com forums. So go to lordshaper.com/forum or lordshaper.com/cryptographic for a link to the forum, and tell us what you think over there.
And other than that, we'll talk to you next time.
Peace.
And that wraps up this syndicated episode of the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo, and I've been your host. If you have any questions or comments, my email address is podcast@comicbookpage.com. Thanks for listening.